And welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, your listening post for politics, Iowa style, where we explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. We are glad you're with us. I'm Dennis Hart, joined as always by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin of the blog site Bleeding Heartland. Laura, it is good to have you on board again, this time from a library.
Yes, always enjoy speaking with you, Dennis.
The library is kind of an inside thing about internet access and all that. But Laura, I can see you and I see the library in back of you. And it's good that you're both open for business tonight.
Thank goodness for good public services like libraries.
Indeed so. We have plenty to talk about and still only a half an hour to do it. So let's jump in. Iowa Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley on Monday, today, if you're listening to us live, voted against Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson's U.S. Supreme Court nomination. He said she is soft on crime and has a history of judicial overreach. Not a surprise that he voted against her.
No, I mean, it would have been shocking if he had voted for her. His whole questioning during the hearings last week, it really didn't sound like he was very open to voting for her. But she is going to have at least three Republican votes on the Senate floor. It was a deadlock vote in committee today in the Judiciary Committee. But Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer can pull her nomination out of committee regardless. And so before they go on their Easter recess, it's very likely that she is going to be confirmed by 53 votes to 47.
That's right. The full Senate expected to vote later this week. And as you say, she is expected to win that vote in spite of a confirmation hearing that was heavy on, what shall we say, culture warfare on the part of the Republicans.
Yes, it was. But I saw some opinion polls last week that said that the vast majority of Americans supported her nomination. And so I think that whatever the criticism of some of her rulings, that didn't seem to stick very well. I don't know whether people just weren't tuned in with what was happening or whether what they heard of that criticism didn't really convince them.
Right. Also a national story involving Iowa. At a virtual meeting last week, members of the Democratic National Committee expressed support for a plan to restructure the party's presidential nominating calendar. What that means is that Iowa could well be on the way to losing its first-in-the-nation status.
Yes, this was not an official vote by the committee, but they are teeing up, the Rules and Bylaws Committee are teeing up a vote later this spring, and it would allow any U.S. state or territory to apply to be one of the early states. There would not be favoritism granted to states that have had that role in the past. And the criteria that they've talked about include a fair, transparent, and inclusive nominating process. And that is kind of like code language for not caucuses, because the members of the Democratic National Committee have expressed concern for a long time that caucuses make it too difficult for many types of people to attend, and that also are not very transparent with the reporting of results.
And of course, there's always been the argument that Iowa is not nearly as diverse a state demographically as the Democratic Party is.
Yes, and not as diverse as the country as a whole, as the whole U.S. population. Now, again, this is just the Democratic Party, and what's not clear is what's going to happen if the DNC votes to remove Iowa as one of the early states, but the Republican National Committee votes to keep the calendar the way it is. As up to now, the two parties have always worked together to keep the calendar the same, and Republicans don't seem to have much interest in replacing Iowa. They're not as worried about the inclusion arguments. They're not as worried about the diversity of the population arguments, and so we'll see how that plays out.
Right. Another story last week that generated, shall we say, political hoo-ha, that's a word I like on this Monday, around the state, a state panel dismissed challenges to the candidacies of six 2022 election hopefuls in Iowa, including a pair of high-profile Democrats and the Iowa's Senate Republican leader. Now, we're going to get to Abby Finkenauer in a moment, but let's talk about this panel's decision and why they had to make it.
Yes. So the first challenge they heard was to Attorney General Tom Miller. This state objection panel, the three people who usually serve on it are the Attorney General, the Secretary of State, and the state auditor. Of course, Tom Miller could not sit and consider the objection to his own nominating papers. So they put that first on the agenda, and they had Lieutenant Governor Adam Gregg, who is, of course, a Republican, replace Tom Miller. So they went through, and there were some elements of agreement among the three panel members. And then there were other areas where the two Republicans, that's the Secretary of State and Lieutenant Governor, outvoted the state auditor, Rob Sand, but it came down to two votes in Story County, which they agreed to count, because if they hadn't counted them, it would have created problems for the whole challenge. It was a kind of complex legal argument, but just to make a long story short, they ended up having to include those two Story County votes, and that put Tom Miller just barely over the line. He got 78 signatures in Story County, where he needed 77, and he remained on the ballot. So then Lieutenant Governor was off the panel, and Tom Miller was back in his chair to consider the other challenges to the six other people who had objections filed against their petitions.
And what we're talking about is nominating petitions, where you have to have a certain number of people sign the petition in each county. It differs depending upon the race. And those were being, some of those signatures were being objected to.
Yes, and this happens every cycle, and that's why experienced candidates and campaign staff always know you never submit exactly the number of signatures you need. You always want to have a cushion of a lot of extra signatures, and it's really not too difficult for a state House or Senate seat. You only need 50 signatures for state House or 100 for state Senate race, but when you get into some of these statewide races or federal races, where you need 2,500 signatures for the statewide offices, including at least 77 and at least 18 counties. And then for the U.S. Senate candidates, they needed to get at least 3,500 signatures, including at least 100 signatures from at least 19 counties. And that's a lot of work. You have to have a certain, they're trying to force candidates to show they have some baseline level of support.
And that brings us to Abby Finkenauer. She survived the first vote last week by the state panel. She survived the vote, barely, and you're going to talk about that. But then just a couple of days later, last week, a pair of Iowa Republicans asked a judge to uphold their objections to her candidacy for the U.S. Senate involving those disputed signatures. So this is a mess, and she's right in the center of it.
She's right in the center of it, and Tom Miller, the attorney general, is in the center of it, because Alan Ostergren, who is the lawyer, he was the lawyer who drafted four of these objections that the panel considered last week, including the ones to Abby Finkenauer and Tom Miller, and he requested that the attorney general recuse himself from considering that because there were similar issues related to missing unit numbers on some addresses and missing dates on some signatures. And so he felt, and he later argued on behalf of the plaintiffs in court, in their court filing, argued that this panel's decision was illegitimate because Tom Miller shouldn't have been sitting on the panel. So it is a real mess. It's probably going to be expedited. I would expect it to get through district court sometime in the next week or so. And the last time there was a challenge like this to a candidate's access to the primary ballot, the Iowa Supreme Court ended up deciding the case by the middle of April. So I expect this to move very rapidly through, and we're going to end up having the Iowa Supreme Court decide whether some of these technicalities should get signatures thrown out or not. Like I mentioned in the morning, the two Republicans on the panel were out voting Rob Sand on some of these issues, but by the afternoon, when Tom Miller was back in on the panel, he and Rob Sand were out voting the Secretary of State, Paul Pate, on some of the very same questions, whether the signature should be counted with a missing apartment number, whether the signature should be counted if somebody made an obvious mistake in writing the date, like one person wrote the year 1952 instead of 2022. Presumably that person thought they were supposed to provide their birth date instead of the date they were signing. So those kinds of technicalities are issues that in the past, this panel has let it slide and has said candidates can have those signatures count, but we really don't know how the Iowa Supreme Court is going to look at those questions.
But the real issue is that Abby Finkenauer, and she's now hanging maybe by a thread, really did not do due diligence in gathering these signatures, because she and her people, whoever did this, just barely got above the minimum number of signatures required, therefore putting themselves at risk.
It's quite remarkable. I mean, I couldn't get a comment last week. I reached out several times to Abby Finkenauer's campaign. She's got a pretty well-staffed campaign. As of the fall, she had 6 or 7 full-time people on her staff, and she's been through this before. She was twice elected to the Iowa House, then she was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives, and she ran for re-election and was unsuccessful in 2020. So she's not new to the petition process. And the strange thing was, as I mentioned, the Senate candidates needed a total of 3,500 signatures, which she far surpassed that. They also needed at least 100 signatures in 19 counties. She crossed that threshold in 20 counties, but in 9 of them, she was only 20 signatures or less over the line. And one of them, she submitted exactly 100 signatures. She had a couple where she had 103 signatures. She had one where she had 105 signatures. And no one would ever recommend that because, as we've discussed, it's very common to have signatures thrown out because somebody signs for the wrong county. There were some people who signed and then maybe a few weeks later they forgot they signed. They went to another event, they signed again for the same candidate. So that's a duplicate that gets thrown out. Sometimes a whole page of signatures gets thrown out because the campaign staff forgot to fill in one of the fields at the top of the page. So it's really baffling why this well-funded campaign cut it so close in so many counties.
Right. And if the Supreme Court does knock her out, that means she would not be on the primary ballot, and that would leave Mike Franken as the Democratic frontrunner for the Democratic nomination to face Chuck Grassley in the fall.
Yes, he would be the clear frontrunner because he and Glenn Hurst both qualified for the ballot, but Glenn Hurst has very little. He may have one staffer, possibly two, but Mike Franken has a full campaign staff, and Mike Franken also ran for the Senate in 2020 and got about 25% of the primary vote then. So he's already a lot better known than Glenn Hurst. So it would definitely be his to lose if Abby Finkenauer were knocked off. She's the front runner if she remains on the ballot.
Stay tuned to Capital Week. On Mondays Live, we will keep you fully apprised on this story. And believe me, it could be a cliffhanger. It really might be.
Well, also, this panel meeting was a real cliffhanger, let me tell you.
Also last week, the state Senate passed one of Governor Reynolds' key education priorities. This is the bill giving families taxpayer-funded scholarships to pay for private school expenses. Almost completely a party-line vote again. Republicans in favor, Democrats opposed. This is really controversial.
There was one Republican senator, Annette Sweeney from Hardin County, and she did vote against this. And I'm going to be watching to see if she faces any reprisals, because this is a priority. And it is very rare in the Iowa Senate for Republicans to vote against bills. In the Iowa House, there seem to be more outsiders in the caucus and people who disagree on this or that. But the Iowa Senate has much more straight party line votes. So when I saw Annette Sweeney voted against that, I thought I made a little mental note to see what happens to her committee assignments next year.
They're going to be very interesting. But while that was going on in the Senate, the House voted last week about an education bill, but didn't address this. This one was a vote to require more transparency for classroom plans and materials, again, largely along party lines, Republicans in favor, Democrats opposed. So the House passes its version of education, the Senate passes its version, and so far the two haven't met.
Right. I mean, from what I hear, they still do not have 51 votes in the House to pass this, the centerpiece of the governor's agenda, which is this public money for, she's calling it student first scholarship. Some people are still calling it vouchers. The bottom line is that families would be able to take some public money and apply it toward private school tuition. And that is what ran into some opposition last year in the Iowa House. And the same thing appears to be happening this year. Now, they did tweak the proposal this year to allocate a certain amount of money to rural school districts, but there are still a lot of rural superintendents and school board members who are lobbying their own Republicans in the Iowa House hard and saying, this would be very bad for us because we could have some people taking the money and perhaps homeschooling. Maybe there's not even any private school in their area, but they might take the money away. And for some of these small school districts, they just can't afford to lose even a few students. That's like a classroom teacher they have to cut. So it could be a big problem. Now, the transparency bill, this is kind of like the scaled back version instead of what Senator Jake Chapman wanted, like we talked about earlier in the year about giving parents more ability to get books removed from the libraries or books removed from the curriculum. This is more like, well, let's give people, make it easier for people to find out what's being taught. Now, some schools already have almost all the classroom materials already online. I know several schools in the Des Moines Public Schools already have that. The bill, it was amended before final passage in the House to remove some of the requirements for lesson plans that could be updated. That wouldn't have to be posted at the beginning of the school year. That's something that could be updated throughout the year. But the irony is, I saw somebody, a teacher in a small rural county, post last week on Twitter that they had Senator Chuck Grassley on short notice be able to come to their classroom this past year to meet with the students. And that would be something that they wouldn't be able to do again, because it wouldn't be part of the lesson plans that they posted online at the beginning of the semester. So we'll see. I expect some version of this transparency bill to pass. The Senate and the governor's office are going to lean really hard on the House to get this private student scholarships thing through, and we'll see whether they can twist enough arms to get that through the House.
Is it fair to say that there has to be really agreement somewhere along these lines with these two bills before the legislature adjourns for the year?
Yes. I mean, I think the governor really wants to be able to campaign on this, and something on education is going to happen before they adjourn. They will pass the budget, which is the must pass. And then there are a few policy bills, including this, including the unemployment benefits reductions that we talked about last week, and a couple of other things where there's going to be some horse trading behind the scenes. And we'll see which chamber's leaders get their way on which bills.
Well, we're about halfway done before we have to adjourn. It is 15 and a half after the hour, wherever you're listening to us across the world. And you're in tune with KHOI Radio's Capital Week. I'm Dennis Hart with Laura Bellin. We're here every week at this time to talk politics, Iowa style, how it's affecting all of us. There were more fireworks last week in the legislature, literally in the state Senate, which passed a bill prohibiting local governments from restricting the sale of fireworks in parts of their community zone for commercial or industrial use. Ah, the fireworks thing. The state legislature legalized the sale of fireworks in Iowa in 2017, and we're still fighting over this one.
Well, when they legalized the sale of fireworks in 2017, and that was reversing a policy that had been in place since the 1930s, since there was a catastrophic fire in the 1930s that caused the legislature to ban fireworks sales. And at that time, they said, oh, don't worry, we're going to still let local governments decide whether they want to allow the use of fireworks or not. So now, a few years later, they're coming back and saying, no, actually, we don't really want local governments to be able to decide that. So this is one where yet another example of a bill that goes after local control. Of course, the cities and counties are very against this bill, but they haven't been very successful the last 5 years in blocking bills like this. So I do anticipate Governor Reynolds ending up signing this or something very close to what passed the Senate last week.
And from fireworks to bottles, at least bottle bill, last week, the state Senate passed a bottle bill proposal. Now, why do we bring this up? It's the first time in years the issue was debated by a full chamber of the legislature. You and I have talked about this. You've been somewhat, shall I say, reluctant to think there's going to be a change coming up here or a bill. Are you changing your mind?
Well, I always said no one ever lost money by betting against the bottle bill in the Iowa legislature. This has been a hot topic in the legislature literally for more than 15 years, really 15 to 20 years. But certainly as long as I've been writing at Bleeding Heartland, they've been talking about the bottle bill, and they still don't have agreement. I listened to Iowa Public Radio's River to River at noon, and they had a senator and a member of the Iowa House talking about this and where they are. The proposals are not quite aligned, but they seemed like maybe they were edging closer to an agreement. But the most surprising thing was that Senator Jason Schultz said, well, if we don't come to an agreement on this bill this year, I think next year we may just repeal the bottle bill entirely because it's just not workable. And that I was surprised to hear that, but the House Republican Brian Losey didn't really disagree. And what is also interesting, in general, when stakeholders have talked about the bottle bill, everybody said, look, we need to increase the deposit, probably increase the amount that the redemption centers are getting, certainly. And most people, members of the public, have said in opinion polls that they want to increase the type of containers to include juice, sports drinks, and water bottles. Now, none of that would be the increased expanded containers. None of that is in either the House or the Senate bills. And they would not, they would be increasing the amount that redemption centers can get, but really they wouldn't be increasing the number of redemption centers around the state, most likely, because both of these bills in different ways would allow grocery stores to stop taking the cans and bottles back. And so what that would probably lead to is fewer people returning the cans and bottles because not everyone has the capacity to drive to a redemption center near them. And there are a lot of counties that don't even have a redemption center in the whole county. So, I mean, that's one of the issues with this bill. The governor has not said whether she would sign anything like this. I think that if the chambers can come to an agreement, she probably would sign it. But I noticed when they were talking about this on River to River, really the only conversation was about what the retailers, the wholesalers, and the distributors leaders can agree to. And none of it was really about things that we've seen in opinion polls that Iowans want.
And again, this has vexed the state legislature for decades. And who knows, maybe we're going to have a resolution that you'll hear about right here on Capitol Week. All right, last week, public, let's go talk about eminent domain. Yes, that's where the government has the right to get your property for public uses and basically set the price. You don't get to set the price. Now, there was a public hearing sponsored by the Sierra Club at the Capitol last week. Drew about 100 people, most of them opposed to the use of eminent domain, especially in the proposals, if I can get that word out on this Monday night, of three companies to establish carbon capture pipelines across Iowa. That's the issue right now with eminent domain. You've got some new information. A key senator in Iowa has spoken out about this, and so has the ag secretary.
Yes. So Senator Dennis Guth is a Republican, and it so happens that one of these proposed routes goes pretty close to land that he owns. Ah. And he is not a big fan of the use of eminent domain for this kind of a project. He said in speaking with Radio Iowa, he said that it's one thing to use eminent domain for a pipeline, a natural gas pipeline that's going to serve a lot of households in a community or some kind of utility project. That's traditionally been the idea, is that eminent domain is used to condemn private land for some kind of public use. But these pipelines would originate outside Iowa. They would go right through Iowa to some other endpoint outside the state. And so it's really not going to benefit Iowans. It's arguable whether it's going to benefit Iowans and therefore whether it has any true public use. So Dennis Guth said he's going to be working on a bill that would be more lasting restrictions on eminent domain. But he really threw cold water on this idea that State Representative Bobby Kaufman floated, that the House Republicans voted to add to one of the budget bills, this one-year moratorium on the use of eminent domain for these carbon capture pipelines. Because Dennis Guth said that he's spoken with the chairwoman of the Iowa Utilities Board, and she said that there is no way they would be using eminent domain within the next year anyway. It's a long process. And so he said, this bill that the House passed, it doesn't do anything. It doesn't belong in a budget bill, and it's not going to stay in the budget bill, because he is the chair on the Senate side. He's the chair of that appropriations subcommittee. So he's taken that eminent domain. He will be taking it out of the budget bill. He is working on a bill, but not one that would be passed this year. It would be passed possibly sometime during 2023. So we're going to see. Obviously, there were a lot of Iowa House Republicans who want to be able to pass something like this year so they can go home and tell their constituents that they voted for something that's going to limit eminent domain for these pipelines.
Right, because this is, of course, an election year.
It is.
It is indeed. State Supreme Court last week upheld a $120,000 jury verdict in favor of a transgender former employee who had sued the State Department of Corrections for sex and gender discrimination. So this was a big victory for Jesse Rowe.
This was a really big deal. The Iowa legislature added sexual orientation and gender identity to the Iowa Civil Rights Act in 2007. So now 15 years. But this is the first employment case that has been brought to court under that specific provision of the act. And it was a unanimous ruling, at least aspects of it were unanimous, that they found that there was gender identity discrimination, and therefore they upheld this jury verdict. Now, there were a couple of areas where the six more conservative Iowa Supreme Court justices did not agree with Brent Appel, who is the lone remaining justice appointed by a Democratic governor. And that was on, there was a question of whether this Jesse Rowe also had suffered sex discrimination. And like the U.S. Supreme Court found in an important case, that they found that under the federal statutes, that sex discrimination, discriminating against a transgender person, was basically equivalent to discrimination on the basis of sex. And the Iowa Supreme Court majority rejected that interpretation. They said, no, he was a victim of gender identity discrimination, not sex discrimination. And there was another aspect of the case that he had been suing Wellmark, the insurance company, and that had been dismissed at the district court level. And that was something that the Iowa Supreme Court upheld that dismissal, whereas the dissenting justice on that point thought that the case should have been allowed to proceed against Wellmark, the insurance company, as well. But in any case, a big victory for transgender equality. the ACLU of Iowa, which had been among the attorneys representing Jesse Vreau, they called it an extremely important landmark case. And of course, again, this is a conservative Supreme Court with six justices appointed by Republicans, four of them appointed by Governor Reynolds. And in fact, the author of this ruling, of the majority opinion, was appointed by Governor Reynolds.
We have about 4.5 minutes left, a couple of major issues still to go. The coronavirus, we can go over the numbers very, very quickly. The number of people hospitalized with it rose last week for the first time in 10 weeks, but it remained low. Things tend to be trending downward, but there are a couple of side issues that are really big. Enhanced food benefits that began during the virus pandemic came to an end in Iowa on Friday, and that's a big deal.
Yes, it is. So when Governor Reynolds caused her COVID-19 emergency disaster proclamation to expire in February, that set this chain of events in motion because the USDA, which administers the federal food assistance program, they had given states these enhanced SNAP benefits. That's what used to be called food stamps, now called SNAP, enhanced food benefits. So everybody getting SNAP got at minimum an extra $95 during the pandemic. And some people got considerably more than that. But so states were given a 1 month phase out period. So March was the phase out period. And starting on April 1st, all 290,000 Iowans on SNAP, and that's about 141,000 households, are going to see their benefits reduced by at minimum $95 a person. But some people are losing substantially more than that. So food banks are expecting a real surge in demand here because a lot of people, some people got notices but may not have known about it. And some people may be getting to the grocery store and trying to use their card and finding out that they just don't have as much money on the card as they were expecting, as they became accustomed to during the pandemic.
And while those folks are losing benefits, the Iowa Capital Dispatch website reported that Iowans forced out of work for refusing the coronavirus vaccine are now starting to collect unemployment benefits because of a new state law approved last October.
Yes, this was a law that the Republicans and some Democrats approved on the same day that the new redistricting maps were approved during that special session in late October. And this was a little bit of a consolation prize. There were some people who wanted the state to ban employer mandates for COVID-19 vaccines. And instead of doing that, the legislature said that if they made it more difficult. They said employers have to allow for certain exemptions, but they also said that anyone who gets fired for refusing to get the COVID vaccine is eligible for unemployment benefits. And now we're starting to see that. Of course, remember that unemployment benefits don't replace a person's full salary, and they also don't go on forever.
Right. Let's talk about E15. Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller and his Kansas counterpart have joined congressional leaders, farmers, and biofuel groups in asking the Biden administration to lift the summer ban on gasoline with higher ethanol blends as part of an effort to lower fuel prices, which we know are going through the roof for a variety of reasons. So E15, we should say very quickly, is normally curtailed in some states from June 1st to September 15th because of the higher blend is thought to contribute to smog during the summer months. So E15 appears to be a love child here for a lot of people.
In Iowa, both parties, I mean, there are very few politicians in either party who will go against the ethanol industry. And usually both the Democrats and Republicans are falling all over themselves to try to demonstrate that they are supporting the ethanol industry. And this is one example of that. So I don't know what the Biden administration, how they're going to look on this, this letter, this request, but it's definitely something that you won't hear a lot of elected Democrats in Iowa criticizing. And Tom Miller is going to be in a pretty tough race for reelection. And so I wasn't surprised to see that he signed on with the Kansas Attorney General, who is a Republican.
And one of the state houses already passed a bill mandating E15 down the road for gas stations.
Yes,
increased use of E15.
Yes, a few exceptions for some older, smaller gas stations, but that bill has passed the House and it is stalled in the Iowa Senate right now. And I'm not sure whether it's stalled because there are key senators opposed to it or whether it's stalled because Senate Republican leaders are holding it back to use as a bargaining chip in some of these late session negotiations to get some of the other bills that they want through the House.
So we have about 40 seconds left. What do you expect to see in the legislature this week? The legislature wants to move toward adjournment, but it's not there yet. It's not close yet.
No, I do expect more movement on the budget bills. I think if they can get to agreement on these cutting the unemployment benefits, it might be that they bring a bill like that to the floor this week. But I think the main action is going to be on continuing to move forward on the budget bills.
What about the education bills? You see any progress being made this week at all?
I don't know. I think that might be closer to adjournment when they reach a final deal on that.
They would like to adjourn by several weeks from now, but it doesn't look, does it look likely?
I think they'll be out by the end of April. I really do. I think they're on track, but probably not in the next couple of weeks.
Well, we're going to be out in 30 seconds. It's been a pleasure having you here again tonight, Laura.
Always.
We are out of time. We'll be back next week. You've been listening, as you have, to Capital Week on KHY Community Radio. And a reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHY or its staff. Laura and I will indeed be back here in this time slot next week, when we'll have the latest on what's going on politically inside and outside the state capitol. Until then, thank you so much for the privilege of your time. We appreciate it. Between now and next time, we hope you have a safe, healthy, and happy week.